This week on Making Contact.
Some people call it two political earthquakes that have really shaken Haitian society and caused a lot of devastation.
It doesn't look good, it doesn't sound good, and I don't think that it is good for the United States to essentially take over the decision-making in Haiti.
Aftershocks continue to rock the island nation of Haiti. 1 million people are homeless, and more than 150,000 are confirmed dead. Mass burials and cremations in the streets have now replaced search and rescue efforts. On this edition, Haiti, its history with the U.S., the militarization of American relief efforts, and the plight of the Haitian people. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. The recovery efforts continue in Haiti amidst a rising death toll, which has now topped 150,000. As the Haitian people continue to struggle for survival, we bring you a story of hope and courage. Haitian-born Danielle Breville is a world-renowned master drummer and a San Francisco Bay Area resident. He was in Port-au-Prince visiting family when the quake struck. He's still there. Making Contact spoke to him from the center of the disaster more than a week later.
I was next to the general cemetery in Port-au-Prince. I heard people start running. And of course, we have to scare because we don't really know what's happening. But we trying to like see the vibe with the ground. Something fell on my knees, but I'm okay. I'm gonna try to like get home as soon as I can.
Danielle was able to make his way home immediately after the quake. He and his mom have adjoining homes just outside Port-au-Prince. The family home had collapsed, but Danielle's was still standing. His oldest daughter was missing, although she was later located unharmed. Other family members were okay, but distraught.
So many people die on just go away to try to like save themselves. And they just run to somebody's house, and that person's house just fed on people.
He says things continue to be extremely dangerous for everyone. With aftershocks measuring as high as 6.1 on the Richter scale, the threat of more damage and lives lost is constant. He says people are traumatized, including his younger daughter. She can't be left alone now.
The vibration never go away. He's still in Haiti. So my daughter is now, the little one, is 4 years old, very sick because anytime he heard people make some noise and she trying to run, make her just like afraid, just scared, like the same thing still gonna happen. So she trying to like run. So I have to be next to her all the time to keep her on me and to make sure she's not gonna run and let her leave us and go away.
Like tens of thousands of others, the family has been sleeping out on the street near cadavers that have yet to be burned.
And it's not really easy to just walk on the street if you don't have anything to do on the street, because the street right now is very dirty. It smells bad because so many cadavers still on the street. Some of them, the government said they can burn the cadavers because they don't have so many people to just take them. So they said if you got a cadaver on the ground, you take it out. If you find some way that you can burn the cadavers, just do it.
Danielle says people are thirsty and hungry and in dire need of medical attention. When we asked Danielle how people around him are surviving, he told a story of cooperation and hope.
People, they share if they got like water, if they got food. We try to like cooperate, make a team, cook for all people together and share. If we got food, we just share it together until that the government or people who can send stuff to other people and to give us.
That was Danielle Breville in Port-au-Prince. The Haitian community has banded together and pooled their resources to help feed, clothe, and administer medical care to each other since the earthquake struck on January 12th. And although aid is reportedly starting to trickle into the Port-au-Prince metropolitan area, there is widespread concern that people are still seeing more guns than aid. Why is that? We spoke to Bill Quigley for some answers. He's the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, Bill, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
As thousands of well-equipped U.S. soldiers pour into Haiti, there is an increasing concern about the militarization of the country, supporting the soldiers and not the people. Why is that?
I think it's absolutely clear that there has been a very heavy militarization of the humanitarian response to the problems in Haiti. And I think the militarization choice is a very, very unfortunate one and reinforces the absolutely shameful role that the United States has played in the 200-plus years of Haitian history, where our responses have often been military rather than humanitarian. But this is, the militarization goes hand in hand with our decision not to partner with the people of Haiti in this humanitarian response. And that is a political response, but it's also sort of a paternalistic response, you know, that reflects United States values, that sees Haiti as a backward country and the people as backward. And therefore, if something is really going to be done, then we can't worry about democracy. We can't worry about consulting with people. We just have to go in there and make decisions and implement those. And when we make decisions unilaterally and implement them unilaterally, there's the feeling that we need military to be able to do that. And I think it's a big mistake. I think certainly the people in the military themselves are happy to be there and helping people to the extent that they can. But it doesn't look good, it doesn't sound good, and I don't think that it is good for the United States to essentially take over the decision-making in Haiti, even when confronted with this terrible disaster.
So what do you think we can do to change that?
The people of Haiti have communicated that they want to be partners and they want to be decision makers in deciding how the humanitarian relief is going to be put on the ground, who's going to make the decisions and the like. And that interest in participating in the decisions about your own community is a very deeply held human right that all of us share. And the United States, after 9/11, we would not have tolerated another government coming in and telling us that because the infrastructure was knocked down and there was a serious setback for the fire department and the police department in New York, that Canada was going to take over those decisions about what happened there, nor would we have tolerated it with the response after Katrina or other natural disasters. And the people of Haiti have the same feeling.
Bill, you're a native New Orleanian, and you were there when Hurricanes Katrina and Rita hit. Now, I know there are stark differences between the two tragedies, but I also know there are some similarities playing out, too.
There are a lot of similarities between what happened after Katrina and what's happening in Haiti, and the people along the Gulf Coast are very clear about those and have been speaking out. Their voices have not really been covered too much, but the same sort of response even happened along the Gulf Coast. There were a lot of people who wanted to help out, but the U.S. government wanted to secure the entire area before letting volunteers come in, and as a result brought in 40 to 50,000 troops and law enforcement people to secure the area. There was the similar media portrayal after Katrina of the constant looping of the images on TV of people looting, and we see that in Haiti with the constant replaying of young kids with machetes or people pushing each other aside, tearing each other aside to try to get water or food. There are some real similarities in terms of outsiders making decisions, militarization of the response, blaming the victim, and in a sense demonization of the victim so that they're not quite the same as the rest of us. And that's a very disturbing view of people in trouble.
And what do you think we can do differently this time around?
There has to be some accountability to the local community in the response to a humanitarian crisis. And that accountability can't come a month or 6 months or a year or so later. It has to be from the very beginning that people who are coming from the outside have to reach out and partner with the people on the ground, because ultimately it is a responsibility of the people on the ground to help themselves, and it's our job to help give them the tools to help themselves. It's not our job to come in there and make decisions about what their country is going to look like or make unilateral decisions on who's going to get aid and who's not.
Having lived through Katrina and the slow rebuilding of New Orleans yourself, what do you predict for Haiti and the Haitian people?
I think there is going to be years and years and years and years and years of challenge and suffering for the people of Haiti. I know one of my friends there said, "Our Haiti is no more," and he was despairing about even the ability of his four-year-old child to be able to go to school, to be able to have a life. And he said that he thought it would be 10 or 15 years before they got Haiti back in the shape that it was before the earthquake hit. And as your listeners know, there was an awful lot of challenges at that time. So I think unless there is a dramatic change in what we are seeing, I think Haiti is going to be facing incredible physical, mental, and community and country-based challenges for years and years.
Bill Quigley, the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, thank you for taking time out to speak with us.
Thank you, Tina, and I appreciate your interest and your focus. You always keep the focus on social justice, and this is a great social justice challenge and an educational opportunity for all of us, so thank you.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. U.S. immigration officials say they expect up to 200,000 undocumented Haitians to apply for temporary protected status, or TPS, in the states. The new status will allow Haitians who were already in the U.S. when the earthquake struck to live and work for 18 months. Gabe Gonzalez is the campaign director at the Center for Community Change in Washington, D.C.
People don't choose to come to the United States solely out of a sense of adventure. Most of them do it for reasons of economic hardship, war, political uncertainty, and that needs to be recognized and to be taken into consideration when they're making decisions like they did around Haitian TPS. We're really glad they did it, and we think it's been a long time coming.
Recently, a report put out by the North American Integration and Development Center at UCLA reports that comprehensive immigration reform would yield at least $1.5 trillion in added U.S. GDP over 10 years.
Well, we have thought, we believe, and we now have proof that if you're able to bring people out of the shadows, regularize them, get them in the workforce, get them paying taxes, that everyone benefits. And it's not simply a matter of paying taxes, though that is obvious. The other thing that it does is, as I said, it raises people's standard of living. They're no longer exploited. We no longer have people racing to the bottom to try and get the worst possible job just to be able to put food on their table.
Gonzalez says they're working with the Obama administration right now to figure out what happens after the 18 months are over. Haitian refugees arriving after the earthquake date will continue to face deportation. And while the international community mobilizes to get aid and guns to Haiti, others are sending money and prayers. No matter where you were in the world when news of the devastation hit, disbelief seemed to be a global common denominator. How could Haiti be dealt another blow when it has already suffered so much? Making Contact's Pauline Bartoloni searched for some answers.
In the days after the quake, the world was asking, why? Haiti, cited over and over again as the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, was still reeling from a decade of deadly hurricanes and the loss of a popular president to a coup d'etat. And now, this? Some people needed spiritual answers. The BBC broadcasted conversations about faith. Then, there was Pat Robertson.
Something happened a long time ago in Haiti, and people may not want to talk about it. They were under the heel of the French, Napoleon III and whatever. And they got together and swore a pact to the devil. They said, "We will serve you if you'll get us free from the French." But ever since, they have been cursed by one thing after the other, desperately poor.
Needless to say, the blogosphere quickly dismissed Robertson. But we at Making Contact look for deeper explanations as to why Haiti's infrastructure was so vulnerable to this quake, and why, as Pat Robertson says, Haiti is so desperately poor. I sat down with Haitian-born Pierre Labossière, one of the founders of the San Francisco Bay Area-based Haiti Action Committee. They're a network of activists seeking democracy in Haiti since 1991. I asked him how he was making sense of the devastation in Haiti's capital.
You know, there is not much anybody can do when it comes to natural disasters. Basically, you don't expect it. It happens. You have no real control. However, there are things that that humans have control over in their communities, which is level of preparedness. We have been so destroyed, our economy, our ability to sustain as a society, to recover, or at least to prepare the population and then to recover, has been so devastated because of economic policies and political decisions in Washington.
Labossière criticized the economics of recent decades that put people in harm's way, policies that force people from the countryside to precarious housing in the capital city.
What has happened is the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, their view and their policies have forced people to lose their ability to sustain themselves as agricultural, you know, as farmers. And so many of them have lost their lands. For example, when they produce their food crops, they are undercut by cheaper imports coming from the U.S. And so Haiti was forced during the 1980s, maybe late 70s, but particularly increasing during the 1980s, Haiti was forced to remove its tariffs on imported goods. And so that left, and here is goods from the U.S. coming in heavily subsidized by the government, and the Haitian government is not allowed to subsidize its agriculture. So that means that the farmers are unfairly, they are not able to compete against these big multinationals with all their subsidies, and they have wiped them out. Guess what? Many of them flocked to the capital city, to Port-au-Prince.
I asked Labossière what the country's foreign debt, totaling at nearly $1 billion, had to do with lack of infrastructure in Haiti. To explain, he went all the way back to the birth of the nation. In 1791, an African slave rebellion put Haiti on the path to independence from France. The colonial power gave the nation their independence, but Haiti had to pay the former slave owners reparations. In essence, Haitians had to buy their freedom in order to be recognized by the world.
So Haiti was forced to pay that reparation. And it's about, in today's money, it's about $22 billion, maybe more. And that payment was, I believe the first installment was around 1826, and it wasn't until 1946 that Haiti finished paying that money. I think the part of the debt was taken over by the U.S., France selling the U.S. part of the debt, and so monies that should have gone to build the infrastructure of the country, monies that should have been invested in the development of us as human beings, was being siphoned out. So it's as if slavery was never ended because those slave owners were extracting wealth from the sweat and the labor of our people.
But the country's foreign debt did not end there. During the dictatorships of the Duvaliers, widely referred to as the regimes of Papa Doc and Baby Doc, the leaders accrued millions in debt, not to invest in infrastructure, but to build their own wealth. Haiti paid dozens of millions of dollars a year back to its foreign creditors, much of it from this era, until some of the debt was forgiven in July 2009. But Brian Concannon, director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, says even with much of the country's debt forgiven, the prior payments did have an impact on development.
Haiti was paying $1 million a week to these banks, and the banks had a lot of money. And ironically, they're not commercial banks. Their mission is to fight poverty, but here they were taking $1 million a week from the poorest country in the hemisphere, and that was in repayment for loans that were given to the Duvalier, Papa Doc, and Baby Doc, and other dictatorships. So there were money that the Haitian people didn't benefit from, but they paid for by foregoing basic services.
Since the quake, international organizations and leaders have called for a moratorium or a complete cancellation of the remaining debt. Meantime, the U.S. has pledged $100 million to the earthquake relief effort. But some groups are calling the U.S. response nothing more than a massive military operation, one that follows decades of U.S. intervention in Haiti. Brian Concannon says the U.S.-backed ousting of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 2004 was partly responsible for Haiti's vulnerability to the quake.
There was a government that was actually doing a decent job, not nearly adequate, but some decent first steps in terms of building public housing in safe places. The United States, along with other members of the international community, actually overthrew that government, and the president was forced on a plane from Haiti to the Central African Republic. That led to a government that for 2 years spent a lot more time persecuting its people and undoing the government structures than building them. And to a large extent, Haiti's still trying to recover from that coup d'etat now 6 years ago.
Concannon said USAID money in the past has been used to fund the U.S.'s own political agenda and has helped to further undermine the agricultural sector. He says that's an important factor to remember in the rebuilding effort.
There's been many studies time and time again that show that food aid undercuts local farmers by you give out free food and people don't buy it. The farmers then can't sell their crops, they can't buy seed for next year, they go out of business, and in the long term, you're losing for the long term agricultural capacity within Haiti, and you're creating dependence on foreign food, but you're also forcing people to move to the cities to live in these precarious places.
Pierre Labossière again.
There is a Haitian poet who once commented, he said, I swear to you all that USA money is cursed. That USAID money is cursed. And basically, that's a comment he was making, because he said the more we hear about all these plans for Haiti, they always have a plan to pull Haiti out of its underdevelopment. They love that term, right? But the more we are underdeveloped, we are underdeveloped. Basically, it is something that has been used really to destroy the local economy.
The Haiti Action Committee's Labossière says he welcomes the global aid and support Haitians are seeing in the aftermath of the quake. But he says the aid should be given as in an exchange between neighbors, where Haitians remain in control of their lives and their land. In the rebuilding effort, Labossière echoes the call by many for Aristide's return. It's an appeal that has been made since the 2004 coup. When asked what he's hearing from his friends and colleagues on the ground, Labossière's passion shines through his efforts to hold back his own tears.
As I'm getting calls from brothers and sisters in Haiti, I see this sense of, hey, we are going to rebuild. You know, it's very strong the way people are surviving. No thanks to the aid, the food, the water, and the medical supplies that are being kept away from the people, but they are trying to survive, and they are surviving by sharing with each other. And the mood is one of determination. You know, we are not going to let them crush us. We are not going to let them exterminate us.
For Making Contact, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
African-rooted folkloric dance is a staple of everyday Haitian life. You see it in many places, including local ceremonies and national events. But there is a community of Haitians and non-Haitians around the globe that has studied the art for years and transported it beyond the island nation. Making Contact's Rita Daniels attended a Haitian dance class in Oakland, California, just days after the earthquake.
I'm going to keep the tradition of African folk, and that has to do with the courage inside. Everybody say, Aibo, bro!
Aibo, bro! Colette Elwa, a folkloric Haitian dance teacher in the Bay Area. She's one of many who lost family members in the earthquake on January 12th. Less than a week after the quake, I ventured out to an event called Pripo Haiti, a prayer circle and movement class in Oakland, California, where Colette was one of the organizers.
After the catastrophe, we're going to have this new Haiti with all solar panels. You know what I'm saying? The first co-opt Caribbean island.
It's a rainy afternoon, and close to 100 dance students from the community have gathered to offer their support through prayers, donations, and dancing. As the crowd gathers, Haitian and non-Haitian, everyone is asked to keep Haiti in their hearts. Guy DeShaw has been studying traditional Haitian drum for several years.
The music that we are playing is not a stagnant music. This music is a living art form that is the life of almost 99% of the Haitians.
Haiti sits in the sparkling blue Caribbean Sea and is the western third of the island once called Hispaniola. It's where Christopher Columbus first landed in 1492, and it's where, by the early 1500s, the transatlantic slave trade had taken root.
When we play this music and we dance this music, regardless of our level of experience, we are preserving a tradition that is hundreds of years old, that has been the true government of the people of Haiti.
Over the centuries, slaves were brought to Haiti from the central coast of Africa. Though originally from a diversity of tribes and cultures, the Haitian people tend to share a common spiritual belief system in one divine being. By dancing, drumming, and singing, the people believe they are granted protection, guidance, and strength. There are many dances that have evolved over the centuries. Igbo conjures up images of the slave rebellion, while Juba imitates working the land, planting seeds, and tells of the connection an agrarian people have with the earth.
When Haitians need answers, they speak to their angels. They consult their Orisha. They consult their Vodou. This is real, live music. You guys coming here today and participating, you have, in many ways, contributed to a living legacy in Haiti.
Today, Yon Valu is danced. It represents the source of energy and life, its movements reminiscent of undulating waves. People began dancing across the room in movements synchronized to those of drums, while some stand to the side, singing. It's overwhelming and painfully beautiful to watch, with everyone dressed in white, the women all wearing long, flowing skirts. Colette Elwa reminds us that the rebuilding of Haiti is going to require strength and determination.
Because there will be people coming in to colonize it again. Yeah. Yeah. That will take people to go in the face and say, we will not let you colonize this country that represents standing in the face of imperialism, standing in the face of what's wrong. Sometimes you gotta sweep away the layers.
That's right.
To get to the heart, and the heart of Haiti is not touched.
That's right.
Ay, Bobo!
For Making Contact, I'm Rita Daniels.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website at radioproject.org. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.